Franziska, grief-stricken at seeing him perish, did not panic. With studious care, she waited for a pause in the wind, then looked back to check where he had disappeared, lest he mysteriously appear still alive. Seeing nothing, she lashed herself as high into a tree as she could, and when the storm abated into that terrible calm which presaged the arrival of the greater danger, she climbed like a squirrel into the highest branches. But as she did so, she saw a young mother with two small children, all so frenzied that none could do anything sensible. So she climbed down, all the way, and found the rope which Theo would have used, and then, with her hands and knees scarred from the bark, she goaded the three others into the higher branches of the tree, where she tied them fast. They were there at dawn on Friday morning, when the cruel part of the hurricane struck. And from their high perch, they watched the town continue burning, with more homes blazing from time to time, while the great waters of the flood began to recede. They came first as a slight movement back toward Matagorda Bay, then as a quickening, about the speed of a rill tumbling over a small rock, then as a surge of tremendous power, and finally as a vast sucking up of all things, a swirling, tempestuous, tumultuous rush and rage of water, pulling away from the terrible damage it had caused. Now those houses which had missed the flames and withstood the first part of the flood collapsed as if from sheer weariness. They had fought honorably and had lost. When the raging floods were gone, and the roaring winds had subsided, and the flames had flickered out, Franziska McNab untied her ropes and helped the others to untie theirs. "We can climb down now. The storm is past." The two children would not find their father. Franza would not find her brother's body. Some mesmerized survivors would not even be able to identify where their houses had once stood, for when Friday noon arrived and the sun was back in its full August brilliance, it looked down upon a town that was totally destroyed. Indianola no longer existed, only the charred streets and the vegetable gardens with no houses to claim them, showing where commerce and affection and political brawling and Texas optimism had once reigned. The incessant gamble, which R.J. Poteet had said was characteristic of Texas, had been attempted once more, and Indianola had lost. By 2 in the afternoon, people were gasping for water as the sun grew hotter and hotter, but there was none to drink, not any in the entire town, and there were no buildings in which the tormented people could take cover. By 4 in the afternoon, children were screaming, and the collecting of dead bodies had to stop, as distraught survivors made makeshift plans for the dreadful night that approached. Franza, conserving even flecks of spittle to keep her mouth alive, comforted the children, putting her finger in her own mouth, then rubbing it about the child's, and in this mournful, moaning way, the night passed. At dawn, people from another town, less horribly hurt, appeared with water, and Franziska wept. "The water destroyed us, and the water saves us." Those first drops, half a cup to each person, she would never forget. Emma Rusk, safe in her little town 400 miles northwest of Indianola, heard of the disaster by telegraph one day after it happened. But she paid scant attention, for she was preoccupied with her son, who each year became more difficult. In addition to his other exhibitions, intended to demonstrate that he was in no way associated with the parents he despised, he had taken to eating gargantuan amounts of food. At the age of 12, he weighed more than 160 pounds, and when his mother tried to control his gorging, he snarled, "I don't want to be some thin, scared thing like my father." She had wanted to slap him when he said such things, but he said them so frequently now and with such venom that she did not know what to do. Dismayed as she was by his behavior toward her, which worsened as he entered puberty and faced its dislocations, for now he identified his mother with the most specific sexual misbehavior during her time with the Indians, she was even more distraught the next year by his relations with 11-year-old Molly Yeager, the sprouting daughter of their foreman. Earnshaw, she said delicately to her uncomprehending husband. I do fear that Floyd is playing dangerous games with little Molly. What kind of games? She had to sit her husband down and explain that if Molly was the little minx she appeared to be, Floyd could fall into deep trouble if he continued to disappear with her from time to time. And when she made no headway with Earnshaw, she went directly to Mrs. Yeager, a thin, stringy woman with a goiter and a passion for singing hymns loudly and off-key. Mrs. Yeager, I'm worried about Molly and our Floyd. For why? Because they're alone a good deal. Things can happen. Bad things. What happens, happens, Mrs. Yeager said. I mean, your daughter could find herself with a baby. What? Mrs. Yeager leaped out of her chair and stormed about her kitchen. You mean that hussy? Before Emma could halt her, Mrs. Yeager was on the front porch screaming for Molly. And when the girl appeared, a plump, unkempt child with a very winsome face, her mother began hitting her about the head and shouting, Don't you go into no haymows behind my back. There was not a haymow within 100 miles of Fort Garner, but since this was the phrase her own mother had drummed into her, it was all she could think of at the moment. Molly, startled by the ineffectual blows, glowered at Emma as the probable cause of her discomfort and tried to run away. But now Mrs. Yeager grabbed her by one arm, while the child spun around in a circle like a wobbling top, with both mother and daughter screaming at each other. It was a lesson in child discipline which Emma could neither understand nor approve, and when she left the Yeager household the two were still at it. Back in her own home, she decided that if her husband would not talk with their son, she must. And when he came straggling in with the snarled inquiry, When do we eat? She sat him down and told him that she did not want to see him sneaking off with Molly Yeager any more. Why not? He asked truculently. Because it's not proper. Her son stared at her, then pointed his pudgy right forefinger. Were you proper with the Indians? And with this, he jumped up and fled from the room, half choking on his own words. It was this wrenching scene which caused Emma to speak with R.J. Poteet when next he came by on his way to Dodge City. R.J., my son is a mess, a sorry mess. Would you please take him to Dodge City with you, maybe teach him to be a man? I don't like what I've seen of your son, Emma. At 64, Poteet had lost none of his frankness. How have you been able to judge him? I get to know all the boys, all the families we meet on the trail. He pointed to three of his young cowboys and said, A boy unfolds the way a flower unfolds in spring. It's time, and inwardly he knows it. Time to get himself a horse, time to handle a revolver, time to court some pretty girl, and in Texas, time to test his manhood on the Chisholm Trail, or on this one to Dodge. What has that to do with Floyd? For the last 3 years, Emma, I've sort of extended your son an invitation to ride north with me. These other kids, I had only to drop the hint, and they had their horses ready, pestering me. 3 years from now, they'll all be men. And Floyd did not respond? Your son's a difficult boy, Emma. I don't like him. She was tempted to say, I don't either. But instead, she pleaded, Please take him. It may be his last chance. For you, Emma, I'd do anything. But when she was about to praise him for his generosity, he halted her. I'm getting to be an old man. Can feel it in my bones. Last winter, I decided I'd go north no more. Had no choice, because Kansas has passed a law forbidding the entrance of Texas Longhorns. For heaven's sake, why? They claim we carry ticks, Texas fever, fatal to their cattle. They've warned me, no more after this year. I didn't want to watch it all come to an end, too mournful, but a lot of families around San Antone had collected steers they had to sell or go broke, so I agreed to one last trail. He fell silent, looking across the bleak land he had helped tame. never put together a finer team. Look at those boys, the two good men at point. I wanted this to be the best drive I ever made, and now you force that no-good boy of yours upon me." He sank down on his haunches and threw pebbles at his horse's left foot. And apparently this was a signal of some kind, for the animal moved close and nudged him. "I'll take him," he said, rising and shaking her hand, "and I'll bring him back to you, for better or worse." It was a curious trip. Traveling slowly, at 15 miles a day, it took the herd 4 days to reach the Red River, and in this trial period, Floyd Rusk learned a lot about herding cattle. "Son, the new man always rides drag, back here in the dust. That's why cowhands wear bandanas. And since you got none, I'm going to give you mine. Gift from an old cowhand to a new one." Poteet had smiled when he said this, but Floyd had not smiled back, nor had he said thank you. But that night, when the hands gathered at the chuck wagon, he asked, "How long do I ride in the dust?" And Poteet said, "All the way to Dodge? Your second trip, you get a better deal." Floyd could not mask his anger, and so livid did he become that his rage showed beneath the dust that caked his face. So Poteet said, "Same rules for everybody. If you don't like 'em, son, you can always drop out. But make up your mind before we cross the Red River, because getting back home from the other side will not be easy." Floyd had gritted his teeth and accepted the challenge. And although he was almost grotesquely fat, he did know how to handle a horse, so he did not disgrace himself. In fact, at the fording of the Red, he handled himself rather well, remaining on the Texas side and pushing the steers into the water with some skill. "You know how to ride," Poteet said with genuine approval, but this did not soften Floyd's attitude, and during the entire crossing of the former Indian territory, he proved to be the surly, unpleasant fellow that Poteet had expected. He was by no means useless, for he knew what cattle were, but he was a decided damper on the other young men, and by the time the herd reached the Kansas border, they had pretty well dismissed him. Poteet did not. In his long years on the range, he had watched boys even less promising than Floyd Rusk discover themselves, sometimes through being knocked clear to hell by some fed-up cowboy, sometimes in the thrill of showing that they could ride as well as any of the old hands, often with the mere passage of a year and the rousting about with reasonably clean, straightforward men. Poteet hoped this would happen with Floyd, and he directed his 2-point men to look after the boy. But when young Rusk repulsed all their good efforts, they told Poteet, "To hell with him. Herd him into Dodge like the rest of the cattle, and ship him home." Poteet did not try to argue. Poteet did not try to argue, for he knew that with 3,000 cattle behind them, more than half longhorns, they had no time to bother with a surly, overweight brat. But he himself could not dismiss his responsibility so easily. If Emma's son could be saved, he would try. And one day, when he saw the boy gorging himself at the chuck wagon as they crossed into Kansas, he took him aside and said quietly, "Son, I really wouldn't eat so much. When you want to find yourself a wife, you know, pretty women don't cotton to young men who are too... I don't want to look like my stupid father." Poteet drew back his right fist and was going to lay the boy flat when he realized how wrong this would be. Allowing his fist to drop, he said very quietly, "Son, if you ever again speak of your father or your mother like that in my presence, so help me God, I will give you a thrashing you'll never forget." "You wouldn't dare." Poteet stepped forward and said, with no anger, "Son, you don't know it, and maybe there's no way of telling you, but you are in the midst of a great battle for your soul, for your immortal soul. I think you're going to lose. I think you're going to be a miserable human being for the rest of your life. But for the remainder of this trip, do your best to act like a man." He stalked away, profoundly shaken by this ugly experience, for he was frightened by what he might have done. His fist had been inches from that fat, flabby face. His trigger finger had been twitching when the boy scorned his father, for it was obvious that Floyd rejected his mother, too. Dear God, what a burden! He was not sure whether it was he bearing the burden on this last trip to Dodge City, or the older Rusks who would have to deal with Floyd back in Larkin County. So now the entire group had turned away from this pathetic boy. Even the Mexican cook was unable to hide his disgust at the way Floyd gorged his food. He rode at the right rear drag, dust in his face, and grumbled constantly about this experience, which could have been so rewarding, this conquering of the range, which so many boys his age would have given years of their lives to have shared. As the herd reached the south bank of the Arkansas River, the men could see on the opposite side the low buildings of Dodge City, and their eyes began to sparkle, for citizens of the town themselves had proclaimed it the wickedest little city in the West. Here were the famed dance halls, the sheriff's office once occupied by Bat Masterson and Wyatt Earp, the entertainment parlor once run by Luke Short. What was more important to the stability of the town, well-funded agents like J.L. Michener bought the Longhorns and shipped them east. As the hands prepared to herd their cattle across the toll bridge leading into town, the older men went to Poteet and said, "Dodge can be a tough town for a young fellow. What'll we do with that miserable skunk Floyd till we head back to Texas?" "I'll speak to him," Poteet said. And that evening he assembled the first-timers and talked to them as if he were their father. "Lads, when you cross the toll bridge tomorrow, you enter a new world. The Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe runs through the town. You can see its water tower. North of the railroad, the town fathers have cleaned things up. No more gunfights, no more roaring into saloons on horseback. On that far side of the tracks, churches, schools, newspapers." "Tell 'em what's south," a point man interrupted. "On this side of the tracks, it's like the old days. Saloons, dance halls, gambling. You stay north, the better element will protect you. You move south, you're on your own." He said this directly to Floyd, then added, "I suppose you'll head south. If you do, don't get killed. I want to take you young fellows back to your mothers." When the meeting ended, Floyd asked one of the point men, "Will Luke Short be in town? He's from Texas, and he's killed a lot of men." "They ran Luke out years back. And you act up, they'll run you out, too." During the approach to Dodge, Floyd had spent hours speculating on what he would do when he reached town. Girls figured in his plans, and the firing of his hidden pistol, and a gallop down Front Street, and a hot bath, and good food. 1,000 lads coming north from Texas to the railheads had entertained similar dreams, but few had come with such addled visions as those which attended Floyd Rusk, for he envisioned himself as a reincarnation of Wyatt Earp and Luke Short, though what this might entail he could not have explained. As soon as the Longhorns, the last batch to enter Kansas from Texas, had been led to the Michener corrals at the railhead, Floyd collected part of his pay and headed to the ramshackle area south of the tracks, and with unerring instinct found his way to the toughest of all the saloons, the Lady Gay, once owned by Jim Masterson. He was startled when he saw his first dance hall girls, for they were enticing beyond his hopes, and when he heard the coarse remarks made about them by the cowhands, he became confused and thought the men were somehow casting public aspersions on his mother. When two rowdy men from another outfit that had started in Del Rio referred to the girls as soiled lilies and spattered doves, he became infuriated and ordered them to shut up. The men looked at this fat, grotesque boy, and unquestionably one of them made a motion as if to push him aside. Anticipating this, Floyd whipped out his gun and shot them dead. Before the gun smoke had cleared, Poteet's two-point men leaped into action, rushed Floyd out of the saloon, and hid him in a ravine south of the river, for they knew that Poteet, always a man of rectitude, would refuse to cover up for one of his cowboys who had committed murder. When Floyd was safely hidden, the two men rode north of the tracks to where Poteet had rooms in a respectable hotel, and told him, "Fat Floyd killed two Del Rio cowboys." Poteet tensed his jaw, then asked, You turn him in to the sheriff? No, we hid him in a gully. We'll pick him up when we ride south. But why, if he murdered someone? Mr. Poteet, we give you our word, don't we, Charlie? It wasn't cut and dried. It looked maybe like they might be going for their guns. Where did that boy get a gun? He practiced a lot when you weren't around. Suddenly, all the fire went out of Poteet. He slumped forward with his hands over his face. Oh, my God, that poor woman, to have borne such a miserable son of a bitch. Looking up, he asked the point men, Must we take him back to Texas? Without waiting for an answer, he rose as if nothing worried him and snapped, We'll dig him out as soon as we sell the herd. Keep him in the ravine till we go south. When Floyd was dragged before Poteet, the range boss tried to make him realize the gravity of what had happened. Son, on the day a young feller kills his first man, he's in terrible trouble, because it came so easy, a flick of the finger. He may be tempted to do it again. Most gunmen start at your age killing somebody. Billy the Kid, and he's dead now. John Wesley Hardin killed his first man at 15. His words had the opposite effect to what he intended. They'll never hang John Wesley, never. Son, are you listening to me? Hardin is in jail for 25 years. Do you realize that if my point men hadn't stepped in to protect you, the people back there would have hanged you? No one will ever hang me. Only Poteet's promise to Emma that he would bring her son back home prevented him from thrashing the boy and taking him back to the sheriff in Dodge. Out of respect for Emma, he would tolerate the odious boy, but he would no longer bother with him. The two point men, however, having saved his life, felt a different kind of responsibility, and late one afternoon on the way home, they whispered to Poteet, We think there'd better be a trial, and the trail boss agreed. Just before evening meal, one of the point men rode up to the chuck wagon where Floyd was first in line, as always. Floyd, you're under arrest. What for? In a whining voice. We know you shot them two men in Dodge unjustified. They drew on me. We know what a miserable coward you are, what a skunk, and we're going to try you correct right now. Floyd trembled as two other cowhands lashed his wrists and tied his ankles together, and he was terrified when the solemn trial began, with Poteet as judge. What charge do you bring against this man? That in Dodge City he willfully gunned down two Texas cowboys. Without provocation? None. Floyd tried to raise his hands. They were coming at me. Were they coming at him? Judge Poteet asked. They were not. He done it disgraceful. Poteet asked for a vote on Floyd's guilt, and it was unanimous. Floyd Rusk, the judge said solemnly, you have been a disgrace on this trail north. You have responded to nothing. You surrendered the respect of your comrades, and in my presence you scorned your father. It is not surprising that in Dodge you murdered two men, and now, by God, you shall hang. Oh, no, the boy cried, for he had certainly not intended to murder anyone in the saloon, and now he pleaded desperately for his life. The cowboys were obdurate. Perching him sideways on a big roan, they led him to the branches of an oak tree, from which they had suspended a rope. When it was tied about his neck, Poteet stood near and said, Floyd Rusk, on the trail north you proved yourself to be a young man without a single saving grace. As a murderer, you deserve to die. Tom, when I drop my hand, whip the horse. In terror, the fat boy watched the fatal hand, felt the man slap the horse, and felt the rope tighten about his neck as the beast galloped off. But he also felt R.J. Poteet catch him as he fell, and then he fainted. Emma, Poteet reported to his friend, it was my last trail. Your check is bigger than ever before. And Floyd? He's no good, Emma. If he continues the way he's headed, you'll be attending his hanging. He stood aside as she wept and did not try to console her. You've got to hear it sooner or later, but in Dodge City your son murdered two men, shot them dead with a revolver he got somewheres. Oh, my God. My point men spirited him out of town, saved his life. So on the trail south, they held a trial to show your boy what such actions meant. He told her about the mock hanging and explained how this sometimes knocked sense into would-be gunmen. But when Emma asked, "How did Floyd take it?" he had to reply, "When he came to and realized the trick we'd played on him, he spat in my face and shouted, 'Go to hell, you stupid son of a bitch.'" Emma covered her face, and when her sobbing ended, Poteet said quietly, "He's alive, Emma, because I promised you I'd bring him back. If he was my son, he'd already be dead." When he handed over the last check he would ever bring to the Larkin Ranch, he said with haunting sadness, "I'd wanted this last drive to be the best of all, an honorable farewell to the great range that you and I knew so well." When he tried to look across the plains, his view was cut by fences. Sometimes things just peter out, like the dripping of a faucet. No parades, no cannon salutes, just the closing down of all we cherished. He said goodbye to this gallant woman with whom he felt so strong an affinity, then turned his horse toward San Antonio. The open range would see him and his breed no more. It was known among the neighbors around the square as the year Earnshaw and Emma had their battle. There was no open brawling, of course, and bitter words were certainly avoided, but the differences were profound and pursued vigorously. When the year ended, everyone, including the two participants, understood better what values animated these two diverse frontiersmen. The Battle of the Bull, as it was called, was a complicated affair. Back in 1880, when Alonzo Betts, the demon barbed wire salesman, gave his night-long demonstration of how his wire could discipline the biggest longhorns, Emma had been surprised that her bull, Mean Moses, had allowed the fragile wires to restrain him. Indeed, it had been mainly his surrender that had established the reputation of Betts's wire as master of the range. Emma could never explain her bull's cowardly behavior, and several times she voiced her disgust. When Betts's new fences had surrounded a major portion of the Rusk lands, and when the expensive Hereford and Shorthorn bulls imported from England were safe inside to cross with the Longhorn cows, Earnshaw implored his wife to get rid of her Longhorn bulls so that all the Rusk cattle could be improved. But the use of this word irritated Emma. "What's improvement, turning strong range cattle into flabby doughnuts?" Patiently, he had explained that the purpose of raising cattle was to produce as much edible beef as possible in the shortest time and with a minimum consumption of expensive feed. "The payoff on thy cattle, Emma, is what they sell for at Dodge City." She said, "I thought the important thing about cattle was that they were just that, cattle as God bred them, not man." "It seems blasphemous to bring God into this." "No, it seems like common sense. When I look at Mean Moses," that's a very unfortunate name for an animal. "Well, he is mean, and he does lead the others, and in a way I love him." "How can thee say that?" And she replied, "I just said it." What she did not say was that she prized her big, stubborn bull, because he, like her, had survived on the Texas plains. She did not in any sentimental way identify with the bull, nor see him as her surrogate. But she did like him, and did not propose to see imported bulls elbow him off her land. The arguing Rusks had agreed to leave Mean Moses outside the barbed wire enclosures, free to roam as always, and to range with him a dozen cows and another bull, breeding in the thickets, their calves going unbranded from year to year, with the herd never increasing fabulously the way the tended cattle did, but with a new bull moving in now and then to give renewed vigor. As a result, the Rusk Ranch always had out in its barren wastes a solid residue of longhorns. In the rest of Texas, the breed was dying out, upgraded year after year into the fine cattle so highly prized by the northern markets. But in Larkin County, Mean Moses and his harem had kept it alive. A great longhorn was something to behold, for almost alone among the world's cattle, it could produce horns of the most prodigious spread, branching straight out from the corners of the head, then taking a thrilling turn forward and a breathtakingly graceful sweep up and out. The Texas twist, this was called, and when it showed in full dignity, men said, "That one wears a rocking chair on its head." Men who no longer raised longhorns were apt to grow maudlin when they encountered on some friend's ranch a beast with really magnificent horns. The peculiarity of the breed was that only steers and cows produced the great horns, and even then only occasionally. Some unexplained sexual factor caused their horns to grow very large in the first place, and then to take that Texas twist as they matured. A longhorn bull never showed the twist, and only rarely produced horns of maximum size. What horns he did produce were apt to be powerful, straight weapons, trained to protect, and if need be, kill. Not much different from the horns of a good bull of whatever breed. So the famed Texas longhorn of cartoon and poster, showing fierce, beautiful-looking horns, was always either a castrated male or a cow. Mean Moses, for example, had horns which came out sideways from his head and absolutely parallel to the ground for a distance of about 18 inches on each side. Then they turned forward, as if controlled by a T-square, ending in very sharp points. Fortunately for the people who had to work him, he had a placid disposition, except when outraged by the misbehavior of some other longhorn. Then he could be ferocious. In the early years of barbed wire and imported bulls, Mean Moses had stayed off by himself with his longhorn cows, hiding his yearly calves in forgotten arroyos and testing his saber-like horns on any wolves that tried to attack them. Four or five times he had stood, horns lowered, when wolves attacked, and with deft thrusts had on each occasion impaled some luckless wolf and sent the rest off howling. Emma sometimes saw her proud bull only three or four times a season, and when she did, she was curiously elated to know that he still roamed the range. As she studied the vanishing longhorns, she noticed several things which renewed her determination. The cows never need assistance in giving birth. Sure, Earnshaw's pampered breeds bring in more money, but Earnshaw pays it out for cow doctors at birthing time. And my longhorns can live on anything. That bad winter when the Herefords died of freezing and starvation, come spring, there my longhorns were, walking skeletons, but alive. 3 weeks of good grass they were ready to breed. And what did they eat during the blizzards? Anything they could chew, just anything they could find in the snow. Cactus, wood from old fence posts, sticks. What wonderful animals! Things might have continued this way had not Earnshaw, always seeking to improve his wife's herd, instructed his Mexican helper Gonzales to round up that last bunch of cows running wild and bring them within the fence to be properly bred. "Okay, boss." The roundup was not easy, but with the expert help of the two black ranch hands it was accomplished. Mean Moses was deprived of his harem. The cows would be bred to the good bulls, and within three generations even the lesser characteristics of the famed longhorn would be submerged in the preferred breeds that were developing. Emma Rusk did not approve of this decision. "Earnshaw, we don't have to use every cow on the range in your experiments. Let Mean Moses and his cows stay out where they've always been." "Emma, the either breeds cattle properly or the doesn't breed at all. The utility of the longhorn is diminishing." "Those cattle have their own utility, Earnshaw. Play God with your English cattle. Leave mine on the range." "Thee will never have first-class cattle." "I don't want first-class cattle. I want the cattle that grew up here." She lost that argument, as did the half-dozen owners in other corners of Texas who struggled to keep the breed alive. Like Emma, they were submerged in the sweep of progress. But if Emma was powerless to protect the rights of Mean Moses, the bull was not. During the famous trial of the barbed wire, Moses had been tempted only by a stack of hay, and the pricks of the barbs were sufficiently irritating to fend him off. But now the essence of his being was insulted. His cows had been taken from him, and this he would not tolerate. Among the 24 longhorn cows imprisoned behind barbed wire so that the English bulls could breed them was an extraordinary lady called Bertha, widely known for two virtues. She gave birth to a strong calf each year, and some aberration had allowed her to produce the damnedest pair of horns ever seen in Texas. It must have been a sexual deformity, for her great horns started out flat like a bull's, and when the time came for them to take the Texas twist, they remained flat, but turned in a wide sweep right back in huge semicircles till they almost met a few inches in front of her eyes. As John Jaxifer said when he drove her inside the barbed wire, you could fit one of them new bathtubs inside her horns. His description was accurate, for the immense sweep of the horns and their smooth curve back to form an ellipse did take the outline of a gigantic bathtub. It would be preposterous to claim that Mean Moses was in any way attached to Bathtub Bertha. He bred all cows indiscriminately, and in a good year he could handle about 24. But it did seem, year after year, that he did his best job with Bathtub, for the speckled cow produced an unbroken chain of excellent calves, often twins. And it seemed likely that when Moses died, one of her young bulls would take his place as king of the herd. At any rate, when Moses lost Bathtub and his other cows, it was not in the breeding season, so he felt no impetus to join them. But as the season changed, he began to feel mighty urges, and when visceral feelings took charge, he was impelled to act. Sniffing the air for scent of his cows, he lowed softly and started in a straight line toward them. Down steep ravines and up their sides, he plowed ahead, across arroyos damp from recent rains, and up to the first line of barbed wire he came. Pausing not a moment, he walked right through the three tough strands, pushing them ahead of him till his power pulled loose the posts, making them fall useless. Ignoring the gashes the barbs had inflicted across his chest, he plowed on, and when he reached the second fence, he went through it as easily as the first. Finally, he came to where the three concentric fences protected the valuable bulls, and here, close to where his cows were, he simply knocked down the barbed wire, disregarding the wounds that were now pumping blood, and looked for the master bull who had usurped his cows. Head lowered, mighty horns parallel to the earth, he gave a loud bellow and charged. "Boss! Boss!" Gonzales shouted as he cantered in next morning with the rising sun. "What is it?" Earnshaw asked, slipping into his trousers. "Something awful." The Mexican deemed it best not to explain during the ride out to the tank, and when Earnshaw reached the fences he had so carefully constructed, he stopped aghast. Some titanic beast had simply walked through them, laying barbs and posts alike in the dust. It had then apparently turned around and walked back, leaving a trail of blood, but taking all the longhorn cows with it. What happened? Mean Moses. And then Earnshaw spotted the real tragedy, for in a corner of the corral, his side ripped open in a bloody mess, lay the wounded Hereford, for which Earnshaw had paid $180. Trembling, Rusk hurried back to town, where he informed his wife, "Thy bull has gored my bull." Emma, who appreciated the increase in her herd which her husband had supervised, was distraught at the damage to Earnshaw's prize English bull. But when she saw the leveled fences and realized the power which had thrown them down, that primitive power of the open range of which she had once been a part, she exulted. Let Mean Moses go, Earnshaw. He was meant to be free. So, because of her stubborn defense of her stubborn bull, one corner of Texas was able to keep alive the longhorn strain. When Mean Moses died, she selected his replacement, a fine young bull sired by Moses out of Bathtub Bertha. This Mean Moses II proved to be almost as good a bull as his father, and in time, 7, 12, and 19 of other bloodlines would be recognized as the premier bulls of their breed. Emma Larkin's love for the integrity of her animals had ensured that. On a cold, blustery morning in March, Banker Weatherby sent one of his five clerks to fetch Earnshaw Rusk, and when the summons came, the Quaker had a moment of queasiness. For some time now, he had suspected that Clyde Weatherby had taken the railroad funds the Fort Garner merchants contributed, and the acres which he, Rusk, had thrown into the kitty, and had spent them not on opinion makers in the Wichita Falls Abilene area, but on himself. And he supposed that Weatherby was now either going to confess his malfeasance or ask for more funds. "He'll not get another cent from me," Rusk swore, as he crossed the area leading to the bank. But when he walked into Weatherby's office, Rusk found that Simpson was there, the saloon keeper, Fordson, and three others. And when all were seated, the banker threw a map before them and shouted, "We've done it. I promised you a railroad, and we're getting one." The details, as he explained them, were complicated beyond the comprehension of ordinary men, and both Rusk and Simpson lost the trail early. But it was a standard Texas operation. Five different railroads are involved. From the FW and DC in the north, a spur will come south to be built by a new line, the Wichita Standard. From Abilene north will come a second spur, also built by a new line, the Abilene Major. What will unite them? A third spur built by us, the Fort Garner United Railway. President, your humble servant. Secretary, Earnshaw Rusk. The men cheered, then they danced. Then some wept, and others set out for beer and champagne. The five clerks were invited in to hear the good news, and they danced too. Rusk sent for his wife, and others did the same, and soon it seemed that an entire town was dancing and shouting and celebrating the fact that it had been saved. "The railroad's coming," men shouted, and some set forth on horseback to inform ranchers whose support had helped achieve this miracle. At the height of the festivities, Weatherby was still trying to explain to the directors of Fort Garner United how the complexities would be resolved. "When we get our line built, we'll sell out to Abilene Major, which will then join with Wichita Standard. Then they'll both sell to FW and DC, which I'm assured has arranged to sell out completely to a huge new line to be called Colorado and Southern. And I know for a fact that Burlington System will someday buy that. So we'll wind up with baskets full of Burlington stock." It was a standard Texas operation, but no one was listening. Emma had assumed that when her husband finally got his railroad, he would relax. But Earnshaw was the kind of Pennsylvania Quaker who had to be engaged in a crusade of some kind or he did not feel alive. Now, in his 50s, with a railroad under his belt, he was determined that Larkin, as the county seat of Larkin County, should have a courthouse of distinction, and he channeled all his considerable efforts to that end. As secretary of a functioning railroad, he carried a pass which entitled him to ride free across the face of Texas, and he found boyish delight in traipsing from one county to the next, inspecting courthouses. On these pilgrimages, he began to identify a group of excellent buildings, obviously designed by the same daring, poetic architect whose thumbprint was unmistakable, and he wrote to his wife, "No one can tell me his name, but he builds a courthouse which looks like the embodiment of law. He likes towers and turrets, and so do I. He likes clean, heavy lines, and as a Quaker trained in severity, so do I. And he displays a wonderful sense of color, which is remarkable in that he works in stone. He is the only man in Texas qualified to build our courthouse, which I want to be a memorial to thy heroic family."